Good morning, everyone. How you doing? G'day online. Great to see you. Everyone coping with Matilda's not having won the World Cup? No public holiday? The news just gets worse because it looks like Collingwood's going to win the grand final. Yes. Yes. The end times are upon us. Oh, if you're a Collingwood supporter, God bless you. God bless you. God bless you. And if you're an Essendon supporter, I've got nothing for you. Nothing. In fact, you probably aren't. You're probably not here because you're hiding at home, rocking in fetal position. Hey, I don't know about you. Do you have, like, in your home, do you have, like family words? Gunk is a family word in my house. Gunk's not what you clean up. Gunk's what you put in your hair. And the kids, not that they scrape stuff off the kitchen sink and put it in their hair. It's just like hair stuff. The kids spend like 3 or 4 hours a day with gunk. Where's Matt? Oh, he's putting gunk in his hair. Anyway, I'll see him at about 4 o'clock this afternoon then. And so the kids have spent about 3 or 4 hours. I put a bit of gunk in my hair. And in fact, sometimes the gunk in my hair sometimes provokes conversations with people. Generally with older guys, and they'll say something like this, "Your hair." And I'll go, "Yes, my hair." "Huh? Your hair. What's the deal with your hair?" I go, "Well, it's my hair." "Yeah, but your hair. What's the deal?" And I go, "What do you mean?" They go, "It's standing up." And I go, "Yes, it's standing up because it's my hair and it's standing up." "Why is it standing up?" "It's a celebration." "A celebration of what?" "That it's not falling out." At which point, without fail, they change the subject. So we're talking about, not going to talk about my hair, don't worry. We're going to talk about relational mess. So we're in week 4 of a 4-week series on relational mess. So I thought it would be kind of fun to finish off our 4-week series on relational mess. I thought it would be a bit of fun to talk about lust. Who'd like to talk about lust? No one. In fact, there are now two kinds of people in the room. There's one group who are going, "Finally, we need to talk about this stuff." And then there's the other group who are going, "Oh no, I finally came to church, and the one time I do, they're talking about lust. How am I going to get out of here? What excuse can I make? Oh no, I can't make any excuse to leave because if I leave, everybody's going to be watching me." We are. I can't leave because everybody's going to be watching me and they're going to be thinking one thing of me about me leaving. They're going to be thinking, lust. But seriously, I don't want to force you to sit through this sermon, so you just feel free to leave right now. You just leave through the door. If we could bring the lights up, not so we can see exactly who it is, but so that we don't want you to bump into anything on your way out. Ah, Matthew chapter 5. Quick Bible reading. If you've got a Bible with you, would you open up Matthew chapter 5? One of the first things I ever found out, I didn't grow up in a Christian home. One of the first things you sort of hear the urban legends about Jesus or bits and pieces, you sort of piece together and sort of come up with your own dysfunctional, misinformed, ignorant view of Jesus. That's generally how my early life worked. But there was one thing, for some reason I picked up this prayer, "Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, look upon a little child," etc., 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 etc. This Bible verse is not "gentle Jesus, meek and mild." This is Jesus go hard or go home Jesus. So this is not baby Jesus or Christmas Jesus. This is go hard or go home Jesus. Matthew chapter 5 verse 29, we're mid Sermon on the Mount. You'll be familiar with the language. Sometimes Jesus says, it's great, please hear me. It's great, but sometimes it's quite crazy great. Matthew 5:29 says this, if your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. It's interesting. Jesus, as usual, is not speaking into a vacuum. And he's wading in like boots and all into what really is swirling around him, which is this national debate in the first century Jewish world. This national debate around sexuality and what's right and what's wrong. There are these culture wars raging from every direction around matters of sexuality. Sound familiar? Sometimes I read the scriptures and I'm going, you know, Jesus lived in this amazingly different world. Sometimes it's so similar, it's scary. And so Jesus doesn't tiptoe through the tulips. No, he goes in. And he's speaking truth. And what he's wanting to try to do is not give people certainty. What he's trying to help people is reach a place of clarity. And he's using the language, actually, of the religious leaders of the time. This language of gouge your eye out, cut your arm off, that's language that the religious leaders would use to try and get people to be more holy and more righteous. In fact, there was one rabbi who would go, you know, you've got to rip your heart out if you've got anything wrong with you. And Jesus uses exactly their language. And the way he frames it is that it would be absurd what he's saying. Like you can really be holy and righteous by chopping your arms and legs off? It would be absurd if the path that religious leaders was, the path that they were taking people on wasn't so destructive and so tragic. And so Jesus is actually leaning into this longing in people's hearts that I think is still the longing of many people's hearts. And it's this, how can I be right with God? We might frame that differently in our time, our age. But you know, life hurtles along at a million miles an hour. We live with this constant restlessness. You know, when there's doubt in our interactions with people, where there's doubt or ambiguity, we fill the ambiguity with the most catastrophic thinking that we possibly can. And we mean well, but we lie awake at night, grinding our teeth. And we just want to be at peace with ourselves, with the world. And I think it actually touches on, we might not have language for it, but we just want to be right with God. And that's really the great theme of the Sermon on the Mount that Matthew 5 is midstream on. But Jesus is calling out the religious leaders because if you can cut off as many arms and legs as you want and you can gouge out as many eyes as you want, it actually won't. If that's your strategy, it actually won't change things, not fundamentally. It's like he's calling them out because what they've turned righteousness and the pursuit of righteousness into is constantly fighting the desire to do something you still want to do. And they've reduced holiness down to not doing what you actually want to do. And Jesus is saying, that's not holiness at all. That's not righteousness at all. They've reduced it to this battle of trying to primarily use willpower and discipline to try to somehow stay in control. And he's calling them out because that's not righteousness and that's not holiness. That's soul-destroying. And so to really look at what Jesus is trying to say and where he's trying to land this, if you can just flick back a couple of verses to verse 27, this is the context that he's using this language. So you can chop all your arms and legs off. You're not going to fight health and wholeness that way. But particularly in this area of life, verse 27, he says this, "You've heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And he uses this refrain to draw on this shared understanding he has with the people that he's talking with during the Sermon on the Mount. You've heard it said. And he quotes from the part of the Old Testament that good Jewish people knew better than anything else. It was the Ten Commandments. And in this moment, he zeroes in on the seventh commandment: "You shall not commit adultery." And he wants them to understand that the nature of that commandment is because the way that we live out righteousness, righteousness is right relationship with God reestablished in the right way, so we can do relationship in the right way with each other. The religious leaders had reduced righteousness to rule keeping and had disconnected it from relationship with people. And Jesus says that is not righteousness at all. So he says, "You've heard it said that you should not commit adultery." But then he pushes it further and he says this, "But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And Jesus is very careful about the way that he phrases this. His words are few, but they're very carefully chosen and they're very carefully framed. Because he says this, "Whoever looks..." And in the original language, without wanting to sound too posh, the original language, the turn of phrase is called, it's called present continuous. It's just not a momentary glance. It's not a glance that happens because of curiosity or happens by accident. It's the look that keeps on looking. It's the second look that leads to the third look, that leads to the fourth look, that looks to the thoughts that if you close your eyes, they're still there. It's the look that you start looking and keep looking, and looking actually, if you leave it to its own devices, becomes a way of life. Not because you're bad, but because that is how life works. And so he says it's not a momentary glance that's the problem. Also this, it's not sex that is the problem. Sex is not this problematic thing that we've got to somehow contain. We're designed for it. It almost sounds cliche. It's a gift. In fact, this was brought home to me in my Bible readings during the week. You know, I don't know if you do much Bible reading. One thing I love is listening to the Bible, because like I just find it helpful. YouVersion, God bless YouVersion. It's free, and you can listen to all these different Bible versions. It's fantastic. So I sit and I'm listening, doing my quiet time, you know, my morning time with God and that sort of stuff. Pretty good. Yeah, feeling particularly holy because I'm having a quiet time in the morning, because that's apparently the way you're meant to do it, I suppose. I'm feeling very, very holy up until the Bible reading out loud starts. And we got to this book. I don't know if you've read it. It's called The Song of Solomon. Have you read it? It says this. So this is Wednesday's quiet time with Pastor Tim. "I said, I will climb the palm tree and take hold of its fruit." Dun-na, dun, 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 dun. Where's this going? "May your breasts be like grape clusters and the fragrance of your breath like apples. May your kisses be exciting as the best wine." And I didn't know whether to say, amen, or sorry. There's nothing wrong with an accidental or curious look. There's nothing wrong with sex. But it's the looking that leads somewhere. And Jesus very carefully says this, "I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully..." And therein lies the problem. Now, this word lust is really important for us to understand in any age, but in our day and our age. It's the word that's used actually in the 10th commandment, Exodus chapter 20, verse 7. It says this, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. When they translated the Old Testament into Greek, it was that word covet is the same as the word lust. At its heart, it means this: to treat somebody like a commodity, like a donkey or something your neighbor owns. And I know Jesus is saying this 2,000 years ago, but suddenly what he says, treating people like a commodity, is suddenly screamingly relevant to Australia in 2023, to any part of our online world in 2023. Because we live in a world that is sex saturated. We live in a world where a catch cry is me too. We live in a world of cancel culture, body shaming, woke. We live in a world where we don't even know what consent means anymore. One of my kids had a consent seminar at school during the week. I said to him, "So what's consent?" He said, "Dad, I have no idea." Because no one has any idea. And right at the heart of it is that, left to our own devices, we end up treating people like a commodity. And Jesus says that if your look leads you that way, therein lies the problem. Now, I want to be true to what Jesus is specifically talking about in this context, because he's talking about looking at a woman lustfully. And I want to speak into that because I think it's really important for how we treat people. Those of us who are followers of Jesus, how we treat people. Those of us who don't follow Jesus and are made in the image of God, the way we treat people. Because we can't be the people who treat others as a commodity. But we know that in our culture, global culture, if you could call it that, women are viewed too often. Women are viewed and presented and talked about and sung about like a commodity. And this is the message that comes up. Reality show after reality show, social media post after social media post. This is the message regarding women. Take me and use me and do whatever you want with me, then trade me in for another one. And we buy into that, and we must not. My kids, we've got Apple Music, like Apple Music, like subscription. And all the kids got their various playlists. There's two words. I've mentioned this before, but it bears repeating, I think. There's two words that my kids are not allowed to have on their playlists, in songs, in lyrics. It's two words, just two words. And if you pardon my language, those two words are bitch and whore. I will not have those words providing entertainment in my family, in my home. I will not have that. People are not a commodity. Women are not a commodity. And 2,000 years ago, Jesus is calling people out that is not the road that we take when we follow Jesus. Jesus pushes it one step further. He says this: "But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And therein lies the problem and the issue. Because you see, our heart, as the scriptures talk about it, the heart is the part of us that gives us wisdom. Our heart, every one of us, it's where our best decisions are made. It's the part of us that is designed for creativity. It is the part of us that has the capacity to enable us to grow and to change and to not just exist, but to live. And it's also the part of us that is silenced and that is diminished by shame and guilt and fear. It's what the Bible says about the heart. Above all else, guard your heart. When David, King David, when he has his most epic fail of his life, this is his heart's cry: create in me a clean heart. His son Solomon says these words: your heart determines the course of your life. That's not just a Christian thing, that's a thing. Your heart determines the course of your life. And in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has just said this: the pure in heart will see God. And Jesus brings the matter to the heart because to find a way up and a way out and a way forward in this area of our lives, our hearts have got to change. And the thing is this: there's only one person who can change our hearts. And so the great theme of the Sermon on the Mount and the great hope for us to really live and rather than deal with lust, actually embrace intimacy, which is what we're actually created for. The great theme on the Sermon on the Mount is this: how do we give our God access to our hearts? And so I just want to land that idea, because it's not trying harder to do better. That's not a pathway out of lust or treating people or women like a commodity. That's not the pathway out. The pathway out is giving God access to our hearts. And so if you want to give God access to your heart, there's three simple ways, amongst others, but three simple ways that I've found helpful. The first one is this: you need to protect your mind. I remember a number of years ago, I was processing some stuff with a psychologist, and she said to me, "Tim, you need to understand the way your brain works, and maybe this will help. It's like your brain is made up of two substances. The first one is Velcro, and the second one is Teflon." And I went, she goes, "It's like when unhealthy or bad stuff your mind is exposed to, it's like your brain is made of Velcro and it sticks. And then sometimes when there's healthy stuff or positive stuff, it's like your brain is made of Teflon, and it just bounces off." And I went, it's like one of the sage insights of life. And you know it's true, isn't it? Because if somebody says 72 positive, encouraging things to you and one criticism, what keeps you awake at night? How multifaceted your awesomeness is, or that one thing? It's the one thing. It's how, and it's weird, but we need to be wise with our minds. And for some of us, we've exposed our minds to stuff, and in our world, in our day and age, often that's been online. And it's stuck like Velcro, our brain like Velcro stuck to it. And what's happened is we've got an injury in our mind. So our brain, it's like it's made of Velcro and Teflon. But here's the other thing I know about our mind and our heart: it heals. And for some of us, there's an injury going on. And for some of us, we've just got to give time protecting it from any further injury so God can heal it. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Who does the renewing? The only person who ever renews anything in Scripture is God. To protect your mind. And that's not just an individual pursuit or a personal pursuit. We need to do this with our, for those of us who have kids, for those of us who have grandkids, for those of us who are carers, we need to help our kids protect their minds. We need to talk to our kids in areas of sexuality. We need to talk to them or their screens, friends, and social media will. In fact, they already are. And here's the thing. I'm not advocating the talk, because the talk is a 1950s myth. It's a conversation that starts with you feeling excruciatingly awkward but the only person in the room more awkward than you is your child. But you've got to push through the awkwardness into a conversation that is normal. One of my mates a few years ago said, "Oh, yeah, my kids, I've sorted. Like, as far as porn and online, it's sorted. They don't do it." I went, "Wow, that is like the most confidently solid statement in that area I've ever heard. Tell me your secret, oh amazing person." He said, "It's a digital fortress." Awesome. What's a digital fortress and where do I buy one? Can I get one on Amazon? And he goes, "Yeah, well, you got to understand, like, I've got Wi-Fi and encryption and blah, 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 blah." I was exhausted as he explained his digital fortress at home. I went, "Wow, what about their phones?" He had a mobile digital fortress following his children around. It was amazing. And I said, there's like a Wi-Fi home digital fortress and there's like a mobile SIM card digital fortress. Yes. I said, "Wow, what about the SIM cards you don't know about?" And he went, "What do you mean?" I went, "You know, like the SIM cards that you can buy at like Coles." "Oh." I said, "What do you do with that?" And he goes, "I don't know." I went, "Oh dear." And he went, "Oh, I might need to revise my plan." I went, "You might need to revise your plan, yes. But can I just tell you step one in your plan? Talk with them. If it's about digital fortress, you're just stopping them doing, you're sending the message, stop doing what you really want to do. That's the message you're sending. Boundaries are important, but they're put in place relationally. You've got to have a talk. My youngest boy, so Josh, we got a rule around conversations. There's his rule and there's my rule. His rule is this: you can ask me anything you want. Anything. You know what? He does. Which is awesome and slightly traumatic. That's his rule. You can ask me anything. My rule is this: I will not lie to him, which is also sometimes traumatic. "Dad, have you ever seen porn?" Hallelujah. "Yes." "When was the first time?" "Grade 6. I was 11. I can take you there. It's the far side of the junior oval at Scotch College under this huge oak tree. One of my friends had brought a magazine. And we looked." He goes, "What did you think?" I said, "It's equal parts thrilling, embarrassing, confusing. I felt ashamed, guilty, and slightly revolted. I was 11 years old, but I didn't feel like I could tell them all that stuff, so I just pretended I thought it was awesome. Wow, the world's changed, hasn't it? I can tell you my first time. But with most of our kids, it's an avalanche, sending a message. And do you know what the message is? To boys, it's, regarding women, it's a real one is not enough. One is not enough. Then when you get married, your wife's not enough. That's the message. To daughters, the message is this: you are not enough and never will be. We can't do that. We can't be those people. So protect your mind. The second is this: this is personal for us on our journey, our pilgrimage of life. Never stand alone. in Christian circles, well-meaning Christian circles, the area of being sexually healthy is fraught. Because we so want to do the right thing, and in lieu of doing the right thing, we want to be seen to do the right thing. And so when we hit road bumps, setbacks, or challenges, or fail, we can't tell anyone. And when we don't tell anyone, you know who the loudest voices in our lives become? Shame, guilt, and fear. There's a proverb that goes like this, not a Bible one, but it's a good one. It takes a village to raise a child. That is true as far as it goes. It doesn't go far enough. It takes a village for any of us to do life well. And a village is made up of people who are trustworthy. If you are not able to be vulnerable with somebody who is trustworthy, now hear me right, vulnerable with someone who is trustworthy. I'm not saying be vulnerable with an idiot. Don't be vulnerable with them. You know why? They're an idiot. Be vulnerable with someone who's earned the right to hear your story. If you are not, at some point, you will be in trouble. Not just this area, in life. Now, this goes against all of my cultural heritage. You see, I was born in a place called England. In England, we do two things. We play cricket and we drink cups of tea. And we most certainly are never vulnerable with anybody. Would you like a cup of tea? That stops all vulnerability. And we're raised, like a lot of cultures, to see, particularly men, to see vulnerability as weakness. Let me tell you, nothing could be further from the truth. You know what vulnerability is? Vulnerability sounds like truth and feels like courage. It's anything but weakness. Remember a preacher saying 20 years ago, a man who's not accountable is an accident waiting to happen. Isn't that depressing? You know why it's depressing? Because it's true. Now, I'm not saying you need a parole officer, but you need a trustworthy, you need trustworthy people. The guy playing bass this morning, access all areas to me. Cam Cutchie is his name. Access all areas. I trust him with my life. But we've walked a journey together, yeah? So never walk alone. And the third one is this. If I could just, for those of us who are married, if I could just mention this and speak to you for a second. Because the idea behind the talk today is not deal with lust, as if our focus should be lust. Yeah, deal with it. But what I want you to do is embrace intimacy. And for those of us who are married, a fundamental part of that is our marriage. And to grow your marriage, way too many people I know settle into status quo in marriage. And I get it. We're busy, we're tired, you know. You've got little kids. If you've got little kids, it's like, oh, I'm so tired. Oh, it's so exhausting. Oh, but this phase will end. I won't be so exhausted because our little kids will become teenagers and then they won't be exhausting. Oh, for the days of being woken up at 2 a.m. in the morning because they're crying because they've got a dirty nappy as opposed to 2 a.m. Anyway, let's not go there. I get it. Life's complex. But we've got to grow our marriage, not settle for the status quo. Because the status quo, just quietly, is going backwards. How do you do that? It's a couple of things Sarah and me work really hard on. Putting each other first. We really work hard on that. Especially when I'm afraid to put her first because I might not get my way. But I don't let that stop me. Put her first. And the second is this. Learn to be able to find the most generous explanation when your husband or wife does something that you don't understand. My question is, was he trying to leave during the lust tour? You weren't. Bless your heart. Sorry, cheap shot. Don't put that online. Where was I before I'm sledging people who've come to church? I'm so sorry. Learn to find the most generous explanation for your husband or wife's behaviour when you don't understand. One of the greatest, in September, Sarah and me will be married 25 years. Like, well done her. Well done me, really, what she's put up with. But it's... One thing I love is I don't have to second guess when I don't understand. But that's 25 years. Yeah. And the third thing is this, learn from your failures. Learn. What I've learned is this, 90% of your failures are good if you learn from them. 1% of your failures are catastrophic. I'm not talking about them. 90% of them, if you will own them and learn from them, will be good. Not adequate, good. You can't do marriage well if you're scared to fail. But learn from your failures. And if I can just have one more remark there for people who are hoping or planning to get married. Just one last thing. And it's this. If you're hoping or planning to get married, don't focus so much on finding the right person. Focus on becoming the right person for someone else. Because if you do that, if you focus on becoming the right person, what that means is your marriage doesn't hang on a vow on your wedding day. It hangs on a path of life that you've already chosen. And it's those choices, the accumulative effect of those choices, that changes almost everything. Is that okay? Protect your mind. Never walk alone. And grow your marriage. Because ultimately, it's our heart. Giving God access to our hearts. He's the only one who can change us. So we lean in to Him. That's what we do. We lean into Him rather than giving in to shame and guilt and fear. We lean into Him and give Him access, simple access, because He's God. We lean into Him rather than giving in to shame and guilt and fear. Because fear paralyzes us. Guilt condemns us. And shame cripples us. But there is another way. Leaning in rather than giving in. Is that okay, my friends? Great. Would you stand? Would you just bow your heads? No, you're kind. Just bow your heads, just quiet. And close your eyes, if that's okay. And for some of us, this area, this is a battle. And for some of us, we've learned marriage doesn't make this go away. But ultimately, the call is to not let our hearts treat other people like a commodity. So just in a moment of quiet, can I please ask every one of us just to put your hands out, palm up in front of us. Because some of us just need to take a moment to give God access to our hearts. Some of us don't need to. That's good in this area. That's good. But some people do, and as they do that, I don't want them to be thinking at the same time, oh, what will people think of me? So you're either putting your hands out for yourself, or you're putting your hands out for someone else. And there is a beauty in that. As we put our hands out, we put our palms up. Lord, let this be a simple sign that we want to give access, you access to our hearts. And therefore, we lean in to you. We don't give in to shame or guilt or fear. We lean into you, not fear that paralyzes us or guilt that condemns us or shame that cripples us. No, we lean into you and the faith and the hope and the love that we always find with you. It's in Jesus' name.